Thank you, Fred. I've got a lot of problems tonight. I might as well get them off my mind right now. I want to thank the board, first of all, for inviting me up here to be with you this weekend. And I've enjoyed every minute of it, right up to this moment. And that's the truth, if I've ever told it. I've enjoyed it very much. It's good to see my friends that I have known through the years since I've been in AA. And my roommate, this is another story, but I won't get into that now. But I never get up to talk unless I'm scared, and I'm scared tonight. And I want you to know that, but I know some other people are probably scared too, so that's all right. I want to thank these fellows that gave me so much encouragement down there in the lobby a while ago. And I've had all kinds of encouragement. A while ago, speaking of being nervous, Fred talking about his pajamas. Let me tell you something that happened to me a few months ago out in West Texas. I was had the privilege of going out there, and I talked on Sunday morning. I got up, and I do get kind of nervous. And I had breakfast, and I was going back to my room, and for some reason or other, I always feel like someone is trying to tell me something. For instance, this movie, after I get through talking, what time is it now? Well, that's telling me something, really. out there at this conference, they had me rooming with an Al-Anon priest. And I thought they were trying to tell me something. And he was a wonderful man, and I was all nervous that Sunday morning, and had breakfast and went back to the room to get gussied up, you know, and got in the shower, and something strange. I never experienced it before. I was standing there with my pajamas on. then the problem did come forward, because as I got out of the shower, I didn't know what this fellow was going to think. And then everybody going back and forth to the meeting place had to pass this room where I was standing. I couldn't hang out these pajamas, and so that was a problem, and that reminded me about his pajamas, but I'm really glad to be here, and I want to thank you for asking me. It's good to be here. I don't know what I'm going to say. All I can say is this, that I am an alcoholic, and my name's Dave Cook. I'm a member of the Big Book Group in Raleigh, North Carolina, which I think is the best group in the whole wide world. And if you don't think that about your group, you better find another one. By God's grace, and because this program works in my life, and through the help of many people like you, and through the love of a loving wife that I found as a result of this program, and through the help of a wonderful sponsor who led me with a firm but kind hand, I haven't found it necessary to take a drink since AA found me. And that was September the 12th, 1957. And for this, I'm very grateful. I'm very grateful for my sobriety. And I'm also grateful that I finally found the God of my understanding. Because for a long while in my early sobriety, I didn't know what my part was, and I didn't know what God's part was. But today, I'm glad that I found my sobriety, and I'm a grateful member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm also grateful for the fact that I found Alcoholics Anonymous at the age I did. And this is no reflection on the older man or woman that comes into Alcoholics Anonymous. I was fortunate enough to find AA when I was 29 years of age. And for the benefit of any new person that is young that is here tonight, I simply say this, that if you want this program bad enough, or if you're willing to go to any length to get it, and follow the directions, which is exactly what he read a while ago in chapter 5, rarely have we seen a person fail who has failed to follow our path. If you are willing to follow the directions, you too can have this sobriety that we talk about. I stand here before you tonight and simply tell you this. This program has given me, many benefits. I can think of many marginal benefits, such as peace of mind to some degree, some happiness, and some security. But any time I start talking about marginal benefits, I've got to talk about basic benefits. And one of the basic benefits that I've received in this program is my sanity. My sanity. And as a sane alcoholic, I find now that I don't have to run anymore. I don't have to lie anymore. I don't have to cheat or steal anymore. And most important of all, I don't have to sober up anymore. And that's what this whole thing is about as far as I'm concerned. This program tells me that I don't have to sober up anymore. And I thank God for this. I really do. speaking about my friends a while ago, and I've got some true friends, and I often wonder when I stand up, you know, speaking before a group, I'm reluctant. I was talking to somebody the other night about this, and I'm reluctant to talk to people, particularly from a podium, because I've come to know in my sobriety that you might be playing with somebody's life out there. One of the greatest things that I've ever heard is a group in Raleigh that has a sign on the podium that says, "Be careful what you say. You might be the only copy of the big book that someone reads." And I say to you here tonight that I only hope that someone under the sound of my voice might hear something that might help them, because I've been there. I know all about it. In my part of the country, we have some people that claim that they took the first drink when they were two, and they didn't have any serious trouble until they were three. Well, it wasn't that way in my case. It really wasn't. I had that magic age, too, that we speak of, 16. And for the life of me, I knew what booze was, and for a long time I didn't understand why me, as Midge was talking about. Because my father was an alcoholic. And I wouldn't say this when I first got sober, because I hung on to that old cliche that we in Alcoholics Anonymous used for such a long time. We don't say whether another person's an alcoholic or not. It's their job to say it. We know what the characteristics are. An old boy straightened me out not long ago about this. And he says, anytime that I see anything that walks like a duck, quacks like a duck, it's a damn duck. Well, well, after I got sober and began to learn a little about me and my alcoholism, I could see this in my father. And I knew he was an alcoholic. He died an alcoholic death. And his booze drinking, I knew what it could do to a man. And as a matter of fact, it led to a divorce in my home when I was 12 years of age. And my good mother took me and raised me and clothed me and fed me and gave me an education. I had one of these mothers that loved her only son. And she really loved me. I thank God for my mother. She's still living and seen me sober. But from the very beginning, as a young boy, I had most anything that I needed. And my mother was able to give me these things. And I didn't know the value of anything until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. My drinking was rather rapid. I didn't drink but for 13 years, but I know all about that black pit of hell we speak of in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been through it all. And I'm not going to stand up here tonight and give you my story blow by blow, because you know most of it. But the majority of the things that I tell you tonight are hindsight, things that I found out about me since I've been sober, because I don't remember too much of the bad things. Been told about them, talked about them to other people, the right people, but it's a lot of it is hindsight. And I look back at my early drinking, and I don't have a bit of problem of getting a hold of this word insanity, because all my drinking was insanity. I took my first drink at 16, as I told you. Went off to school, and that's where I was when I took my first drink. I wanted to do what the big boys were doing. They'd just come back from World War II. These veterans, a lot older than I was. And I remember the first time I ever got drunk. I remember the effects of it. I remember how sick I got. And I don't know how long it was for a period of time before I took another drink. But I remember some of this. And from the very beginning in my early drinking, when I got into hard booze, I had a hard time holding this stuff down. And I heard some of these older boys talking about the pleasure you get out of drinking, the pleasure that comes from it. And I asked one night, I said, "Where does this pleasure come in?" You see, I was throwing it up most of the time. It was burning me. And I said, "Where does the pleasure come in?" And one old boy called me to the side and says, "Dave," he says, "if you remember," says, "there's a pause in between from the time you take the drink and when you throw up. That's the pleasure." Well, I was having a heck of a time there for a while, but through my college days, my drinking progressed, and it was all fun drinking. Oh, I got into fun trouble, good times, and this is where I learned how to drink in college, being around a bunch of fellows a lot older than I was. I don't know when I crossed this invisible line. To me today, it's not important. But I can look back and see some of the characteristics that presented itself in my own life at that time, because maybe maybe, just maybe, my alcoholic behavior started along about then. I studied engineering in college, and because I was off to school on a partial basketball scholarship, I decided that I was off the job coaching high school basketball when I graduated. And I went out into the community to where I coached down in eastern North Carolina, and I made up my mind that what I would do is just set an example for young people in the community. Because, after all, coaches don't drink. And all I did, I just got drunk at home on the weekends when I went to my mother's. I was allowed to drink at my mother's home. But in the community where I was teaching and working, I did not drink. And this went on for a period of about a year and a half, until gradually I began to meet some of my former schoolmates at various cities throughout the states on the weekends to get together, to drink a little. And the weekends got more frequent, and we got a little drunker. And after I'd have been in the school teaching business about 2 years, I'd fallen upstairs in the coaching profession, and I was offered a job at a much larger high school, and I began to drink more. And then I found a wonderful salvation for a drunk or a potential drunk. I've looked back, and I began to associate with people that were school board members that drank. And I've looked back, and I never had anything to do with any of them that did not drink. And these people gave me an out for the middle of the week. And it wasn't long before it was an every night affair, a weekend affair, and it got to the point that booze was in my life all the time. It got to the point that I had to have the morning drink, and you know what I'm talking about. And this is when I was at school and been teaching for about 3 years. And you begin to get in trouble on account of these things. And the trouble came, and it came rapid. Because not only did I let go of my responsibilities in the profession that I was supposed to be doing, these financial problems began to arise. My mother was in a position to help me out for a good while. And I began to develop this, I call it a disease, I don't know what you call it, this business of writing checks. And really, I never wrote a check in my life when I was drinking that I wasn't going to make good the next morning, and you haven't either. And I began to do this, and it wasn't long before one of the sheriffs of the county would come to the schoolhouse to see me about some of these things, you know. And I can look back now and see my alcoholism now and remember some of my thinking. And some of my thinking was this, because I can remember when that, well, we call him the Black Mariah, with one of those buggy whips waving in the air, you know. And he'd drive up to the schoolhouse, and I'd go on the outside and begin to talk to me. And you could see him peeping, you know, out the windows, and some of the people looking and wondering what was going on. And my thoughts were, I am an undercover agent for the sheriff's department. They don't know it, so that's the way it is. And yet my thinking, and this was my thinking at that time, that I was working for the sheriff's department. And, hell, this should tell you something at this age, but that's the way it was then. Well, the drinking progressed to the point that the school board officials began to talk to me about my drinking. I remember the first time I was called on the carpet about this. I'd been at this second school for 4 years then, and it was just everybody in the community knew I was a community drunk except me. And they wanted me to do something about it, and I had a man that I was working with who was very interested in me, and I was young, and he talked to me like a father and wanted to help me, and said I had to do something about my drinking. And I resented him, and that night I made up my mind that I'd get him off my back, and I did for a period of time. I decided what I needed was some companionship, and so I sought me a wife, and I found me a wife. We courted for 2 weeks, and we were married. And this girl, I've never blamed her for my drinking at all, and she knew how much I drank when she married me. And our marriage was a bust from the very beginning. Well, I don't know if you've ever heard of one, but we had a group honeymoon. We carried three other couples on the honeymoon. And this is the way my marriage started. And problems began to come up. And when we came back from this 60-day honeymoon, I promised this girl that I'd stop drinking when school started in September. And the time came in September for me to stop drinking, and I couldn't stop. And prior to this, my good mother had sent me to some drying out places, the nice ones. I'd been to some nice drying out places. I'd had some doctors to try to help me. and people were concerned about me at home, my loved ones. And the drinking got worse, and then eventually led to me losing this job at this school. But there was an incident that happened that, well, I wouldn't tell it for a long, long time, but it's funny now. Because this is what led to me being fired from this school. And it was on account of a girls' basketball team. That's all it was. I'd been coaching boys' basketball for a number of years, and we had a girls' basketball coach who had to go into service, and they asked me to take over this girls' basketball team in the middle of the year. And you'll have to understand, I was going to these ball games half boozed up, half tanked up, and these kids knew it. And I didn't think you could smell it, you know. I was drinking vodka then, and it'll leave you breathless, I'll tell you that. I was just loose as a goose most of the time. And this particular night, the first game I had these girls, you know how it is, you huddle around, and I'd been in the habit of patting these boys on the rear, you know. And to give them spirit and so forth, I began to pat the girls on the rear, and you know what happened. Some parents came down out of the stands, and there was a general commotion, and needless to say, my school board met the next morning, and they gave me the riot act. And that's the truth. That's how I left this school, was on account of this girls' basketball team. And I was getting to the point then in my drinking that I didn't much care. That's the truth. And this girl that I was married to, we had found out previous to this that this marriage wasn't going to work. But yet, and this is irony, this is the alcoholic, I thought that because of the embarrassment that would be in the community, yet I'm the community drunk, that we would not seek a divorce. And we lived together a year and a half under these conditions. And I drank all that summer, and then my booze drinking was just out of proportions. I mean, to breathe, I had to drink. And this is at the age of 27. And came school time, I was lucky enough to find a job. They came looking me. And when they come looking you in the school teaching business, if you are drunk and they know about it, they are really desperate. And this was a rock bottom of schools, and down in far distant Eastern County, and they needed a boys basketball coach. And this man hired me. But you'll have to understand, it was just 3 days before school started, and he knew about my drinking. But this was the rock bottom of schools in my state. That's the truth. But yet in my own mind, I was there for a purpose. And this school was to become accredited by me. And this was my thinking. And my drinking just got completely out of control at this school, because that September, it lasted from that September to the following February. And the only way I can describe my drinking at this time is simply that I had to get up at 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning and drink a pint of booze in order to stop shaking, so I could get my clothes on and shave and bathe and get in the car and drive 12 miles and get to that schoolhouse and just suffer till 12 o'clock came, when invariably those shakes would start then, and I could find somewhere I'd had hid in the gymnasium, my automobile, and take a few drinks and pray for 3 o'clock to get back in that automobile and drive back to Rocky Mount, to go to the beer joints, drink beer to quit in time, and go by the ABC store and buy enough booze to go home and get stoned to the ears again. And this went on from September to the following February. And one day at school in February, and in the meantime, this wife had enough and she left. And when she left, she took about everything we had. I was confronted one day at school by the principal, who stopped me in the hall and just asked for the keys. He said, "Dave," says, "you're through. We don't need you anymore." And he didn't even call me in the conference room. There was no big argument. I didn't cry, and that's unusual at that time. He said, "You're just through." And I didn't argue one bit. And I've looked back often in my life at this moment in my drinking and wondered what happened. And I know now what happened to me at that time. I'd come to the point in my life that I didn't care whether I lived or died. But I wanted that booze around me. And booze had me then. And I think somewhere prior to this is when I crossed this invisible line. I don't know. But booze had got me and I didn't know it. The after effects of this period of time was I had my first prolonged blackout. And I knew what blackouts were. I experienced them. I was gone somewhere for a period of about 2 weeks and woke up in jail for the first time in my life in the city where I was teaching school. Didn't know where I'd been or what I'd done. And when I came to, there was a man standing outside the cell door began to talk to me. I later found out he was a county health doctor. And this man said, "Son," says, "your mother has come down here and she's straightened out all this mess and we're going to send you to a place where they can cure you." Now, I didn't know what had happened. I later found out what had happened, and you're not interested in that, but I really got into trouble. It took a lot of money. But when he said, "We're going to send you to a place where they can cure you," I didn't know what he was talking about. I really didn't. I knew I was physically run down, and my health wasn't good, but the drinking bit, this wasn't a problem with me at that time. And later I found out where the cure was to be. And when he said this, I could immediately see palm trees or soft green grass or umbrella old man, you know, drinking mixed drinks and, you know what I mean, these nice drying out places. Back in my home state, we have a place called Dix Hill. Some of you are familiar with it, I know. And my favorite expression is, I too found my thrill on Dix Hill because... That's where I went for the cure the first time, and I was 28 years of age. 28 years of age in the insane asylum. And that's what it was, on account of my drinking. Now, I'd like to emphasize something right here, and be understood about this, that you don't have to go through and do everything I did to get to Alcoholics Anonymous, or to become an alcoholic. This alcoholic did. This one did. Because of my mother and finances, it didn't have to be this way. It could have been another way. But it had to be this way for this drunk. And I thank God for it today. Because at this time, I still have this problem that the alcoholic has. And this is the insanity of the disease as far as I'm concerned. I did not have the ability to see myself as I really was when I was the sickest. And this is the thing that just about killed me. My inability to see myself at my worst. And it took me a long, long time. And it took AA to prove it to me. Well, I went to Dix Hill my first time, and this is a thing in my life I never want to forget as long as I live. I was put in one of these places, what they call Skid Row, which is a padded cell, where you turn you loose and you have your running fits. And that's what I did. I had my running fits in this padded cell for about a week. No medication. No therapy of any type, and then they turn you out when you get well. And the only thing you had to do then was to walk up and down a hall. And I began to walk, and I began to look around me, and I began to wonder why I was there. And I saw some men there a lot older than I was, but I didn't see anybody there my age. Nobody my age. And I began to listen to these men talk. And I heard a man say one night, "I'm here because my damn wife put me here." And then I heard a man say, "I'm here because I'm an alcoholic. I'm here because I'm an alcoholic." And for the first time that I can recall in my life, I heard the word alcoholic. Get this now. I knew exactly what it meant. But what was built into me at that time, I resisted the word. No, not me. Not me. I'm not an alcoholic. I'm not. Still this inability to see myself. And here I am over in the nut house on account of my drinking. Well, I stayed at Dix Hill the period I was supposed to. Never forget the day I was discharged for the first time. They called me into the front office, and this superintendent says, "Dave," says, "we think a mistake has been made." And I said, "Yes, sir, I think so, too." He says, "We usually tell the people that come here, we'll see you on your next trip. And a mistake has been made in your case, we think." But the strange thing about all of it is when I got ready to leave Dix Hill, I didn't have anywhere to go. Nowhere. Everything I had that I owned was on my back. But my good mama, My good mama had made arrangements for me to come home again. Now here's a man, 28 years of age, with a college education, goes back to his hometown, been away for years, been successful to some degree, comes back home, and everybody knows he's sick except him. And that's the way I was. Oh, people begin to ask me, where have you been? What happened? Nervous breakdown, you know, been in the state hospital, not Dix Hill, state hospital. And so I came in contact with our family doctor to a good degree then, and I don't know anything about pills, but I knew something at that time about them because my good doctor gave me some things to take, some tablets, I call them, some tablets to take, and I began to take these tablets, and I didn't have a bit of trouble there for a long, long time because, well, stoplights didn't bother me, nothing bothered me. I just, in another world. And I coasted along with this for about 6 weeks, and one night I was with a bunch of my friends, and I just decided I'd drink some with them. And I took another drink, and I got drunk. And needless to say, I went back to the place I said I'd never go again, which was the state insane asylum. And to make a long story short, I went back to Dix Hill 5 times in 6 months, and I'm not proud of this. 5 times in 6 months, and each time I went back, my resentment was more, and I was sicker. I was sicker each time, and I began to despise people for what I thought were putting me there, and yet it was me all the time. I went back to Dix Hill my last time and don't remember it because I had taken the antabuse reaction test. I've tried antabuse, and believe me, it don't work if you drink on top of it. I tried it twice. But the last time I went back, they carried me back in the ambulance. And this time I woke up in the bug part of the nut house instead of the whiskey part. And there is a distinct difference. Let me tell you that. There is a distinct difference. And I began, when I came to and the people that I were around, I didn't know what in the world had happened to me. And I found out something about straitjackets and chewing your tongue. And I found out how you live better electrically, too, on this trip. That's a lot of fun. But, you know, strange as it may seem to some people, I can remember some of these moments in this ward that I was with, in the people that I was with. And I can remember telling myself, well, I'm going to be here until I die. And I am crazy. I'll have to accept it. And I can remember some of these shock treatments, what happened to me, my thinking. But, you know, somebody was looking after me. Maybe it was a coincidence, as we say in AA, but somebody made a mistake one day because one day I was carried back to the alcoholic ward, and I've got papers to prove that I was legally insane. Carried me back to the alcoholic ward and put me with the rest of the drunks. And I'd been there so much that more or less made me an honorary attendant. And one day, going to get the mail, I decided I'd run away. I escaped with two other fellows, and that night I was drunk in Raleigh, North Carolina. 3 days later, I was put on a bus by a friend of the family who saw me in Raleigh, who'd financed 3 days of my drinking to help me get home, you know, and finally found me again and put me on a bus and sent me back to my mama's home. And my mother, when I got home, I later found out she was in the hospital in Richmond, Virginia with a nervous breakdown. And I broke into her home and stayed there for 2 weeks until they brought mother home from the hospital and they found me. And they thought old Dave was off for the cure again, you know. And when they found me, they got together. And let me tell you something, when they get together, you better watch out. Something's going to happen. And they got together that afternoon. When I say they, I mean my two sisters and my mother and a close friend of the family who's been like a father to me. And the end result of the whole discussion was they gave me a lot of money. And it was enough money to go a long, long ways and live good for a period of time. And told me to leave and never to come back. And I know now that I was an alcoholic because I went every bit of 4 miles from my hometown. That's as far as I went. Over to my neighboring town and pulled into what I call my paradise at that time, an old broken down hotel, and began to drink and drink. And when the money ran out, I reverted back. I reverted back to the same thing I'd always done before. When I needed money, I'd write a check. And I'd go over to my hometown and write a few checks and come back to my paradise and drink. And one day I went over there and I made a terrible mistake. I bought bought an outboard motor. I didn't have no boat, but I bought an outboard motor. You know, write a big check, get the change, pick up the motor later. And they called Mother to tell her that my motor was ready. And, she knew what had happened, and the law came, and I was carried back to my hometown and put in jail again. And I stayed in this hometown jail of mine for 2 weeks, 3 blocks from my mama's home, and each day the sun came up, I knew she'd be down there to let me out of that place. And I just knew she would. And Mama didn't come. Nobody came. Nobody. I even thought maybe my old brother-in-law might come down there and look at me, you know, but he didn't even come. Nobody came. And one morning, they carried me upstairs, and I stood trial in a court of law for something that I didn't know I'd done on this last drunk. Something that I didn't know I'd done. And I remember that chief of police words, and I hope that I always remember him. He said, "That's Ms. Cook's boy." He says, "You carry him back downstairs. We know what to do with him." And I thought maybe she might be there that afternoon, but she didn't show up. The next morning, they carried me to another courthouse down the road a little bit further. And again, I had to stand trial in a court of law for something I didn't know I'd done. And the end result was that any of you have ever heard of the Great Dismal Swamps know what I'm talking about. I had to be put on a chain gang. And there I was in the Great Dismal Swamps on a chain gang for what I'd done on account of my drinking. And I'm not proud of this. I'm ashamed of it. But I tell you with all sincerity, from the bottom of my heart, if it took this for this drunk to eventually get to Alcoholics Anonymous, I thank God for it. I do. And that's what it took. That's what it took. And still at this place, I couldn't see that drinking was my problem. Still this insanity. I did some things at this place I didn't think I could do, but I had to. And you can imagine how it was for me. I remember when my first interview, I told them I was a school teacher. And boy, they really worked me over. But I became a part of these people because I had to live, I had to exist among them. And I hope I never forget it because it was good for me at that time. I didn't know it. And needless to say, you know, it's strange. All those bib bottles and empty bottles I used to throw on the one out of the car, I never knew that someday I'd have to come out and pick them up. But that was part of it. I did. And I stayed there the period I was supposed to. And when I got ready to leave, I didn't want to leave. I was full of fear because I was full of shame. And nobody in my family would have anything to do with me. And they took me back to my hometown on a Sunday when I got through and put me out. And I walked to my mother's home through this small town of about 3 miles to her back door. And knocked on this door and she came. And you see, I didn't know this, but I tried to take my mother's life on my last drunk and didn't know a thing about it. And this woman was scared of me. And she came to this back door and began to talk to me and gave me some food to eat. And I looked good. I was brown and I wasn't fat, but I was tough. And she called them together and they got together again that afternoon. And I heard them in there arguing. And this is good for the alcoholic, you know. I heard my brother-in-law, his words, that I was an outcast of society. Couldn't set foot on his place. But I heard my mama say, "That's my boy. And he's going to stay here tonight whether you like it or not." And that moment I made a promise to myself. And I don't recommend this before AA or after AA. I made a promise to myself that I would stop drinking on account of my mama. And I was able to do it for a period of time. One day it was suggested, well, maybe you should go back to work. I didn't think I could get a job teaching in North Carolina. I really didn't. And through an agency up in Richmond, Virginia, I was interviewed for several jobs in various states. And my good mother carried me to these places to talk to these people. Pennsylvania, Maryland, Delaware, and finally up in the Shenandoah Valley of Virginia, up in Roanoke, Virginia. And I remember the day I got to Roanoke, Virginia, and this man interviewed me, and he really seemed interested in me. And we began to talk, and still, you'll have to remember this, school was to open the next week. And he says, Dave says, we got to find out something about you in North Carolina. And right then, well, I knew what was going to happen, you know. And he got on the phone and he came back, and it's amazing to me what they can find out in 5 minutes over a telephone. And he said, we understand that you had a drinking problem at one time, but that you're cured now. And I said, yes, sir, I am. I am. And he says, good, we want you to go to work. This was on a Thursday, and I had to be back in this city the following Saturday. I went back to my home, and my mother gave me the money, gave me the clothes, gave me a new start, to start a new life. And this was a wonderful opportunity for me, in spite of what I'd been through already, in spite of my background, where I was. And on the way to this city, I had to change buses. And I decided what I would do was take one drink on this Saturday afternoon. Just one drink. But I bought 2 pints. Bought 2 pints to take one drink. And when I got to Roanoke, Virginia that night, instead of going to the place where I had engaged a room to live that year, I checked into the big hotel. Checked into the big hotel. And simply what happened to me, I was later told in a period of 24 days, was simply this, that I lost everything that I had. Everything. I lost the job twice. And I got back into the squirrel cage drinking. Got kicked out of the hotel eventually. And what happened to me simply was this, that I was a bum. And I had to be on the market down in Roanoke, Virginia, sleeping on the bridges at night. And this happened to this drunk. And it didn't have to be this way. But it was. And the only man that knew me in this city was this one man that had hired me. He'd gotten in touch with my mother about 2 weeks after I'd been on this drunk for about 2 weeks. And she had gotten me to a telephone. And my mama gave me the greatest gift she ever gave me that day, since the day I was born, when she said, you're no longer my son. Don't you ever set foot at my home again as long as you live. And she meant it, and I knew it. And for the first time in my life, I was all alone. Didn't have anybody. Strange city, didn't know a soul. I got into that drinking bit, and the horrors and the terrors of that last drunk, I never want to forget it. The screams in the night. A falling leaf was like a footstep in the dark. Somebody looking at me. And finally this man found me on Skid Row in Roanoke and wanted to help me. He had no knowledge of Alcoholics Anonymous, but he had a friend that did. And he contacted these AA people in Roanoke, Virginia, and they carried me down to a club room that Sunday afternoon. Now, I didn't know where I was going or what was going to happen. But something had happened prior to about 4 hours this man finding me. I had come to a point in my life about 4 hours before this man found me when I gave up. I finally came to realize that drinking booze was killing me. And I didn't know what to do about it. I thought I was the only man on the face of the earth like this, in spite of the places I'd been and what I'd seen. And he carried me to this Easy Desert Club, they call it, the 12-step house down in Roanoke, Virginia, and he carried me up some steps, and some people got around me and began to talk to me, and they began to talk on the side, and then an old gentleman called me to the side, and I'll never forget him. He was 82 years at that time, 82 years old, and had been sober 6 years, old John Tulloch. And old John Tulloch told me the magic words of Alcoholics Anonymous as far as I'm concerned. Just like he read in chapter 5 a while ago. Follow the directions. This old man says, son, says, I want to tell you something. Says, all you've got to do is listen to these people and you never have to be alone again. You never have to be alone again. And my God, I really think that that's what kept me sober. I know my first minute, maybe my first hour, first year, that I didn't have to be in this hell anymore, that I didn't have to be alone anymore, that there was some hope for me. And that night they carried me to my first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. Never been to one. I don't remember anything about it except one thing, and that was the people talking to me after the meeting and grabbing me by the hand and saying they loved me. And they knew what it was like. And 3 men that night stayed with me all night. Because that afternoon I began to talk to them and become friends, you know. The alcoholic, in spite of sobriety as far as I'm concerned, still has the ability to con himself, and I was still a con man at that time. And I told these people that I needed a drink. And this was good for me. And this man says, no, says, we don't think so. We want you to suffer a little. And I asked for some pills, and they said, no, says, we're going to do it another way, cold turkey. Now, I want to tell you how smart I was when I got to AA. When he said cold turkey, honestly, I didn't understand how sliced cold turkey was going to do me any good. That's the truth. Well, that night, these men stayed with me, and the reason they stayed with me is because I began to shake. And they stayed with me all night long, all three. And I remember telling them that I was going to die. And they said, no, said, try it for 1 minute. And 1 minute would go by, and they said, you made that one. Try another one. And then an hour came, and finally the sun came up the next morning. And they carried me back to this clubhouse, and I sat down and talked to a man who was to become my sponsor. And this man sat me down and began to tell me about Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, the group I came into in Roanoke, Virginia, the old Central group, was one of these groups that didn't pussyfoot around about the program of AA. And they began to tell me what I had to do, what I had to do. And my sponsor sat me down. He asked me 3 questions, and I asked my pigeons the same 3 questions. He says, Dave, says, are you willing to quit drinking? Do you want to quit drinking worse than anything else on God's green earth? Will you do what we tell you to do? Will you follow the directions? And then he says, are you willing to quit drinking forever? And I didn't know, I knew what forever was, and I lied to him. And I said, yes, I'm ready to quit drinking forever. But our big book says it's possible. If you follow this program, you don't have to drink anymore. And that's what he was trying to tell me. And this man told me all about AA. And that afternoon, he had me making some amends because I had about $1,400 worth of bad checks in this city. And I went to see them people that day, my first day of sobriety. And my Lord, I'll never forget it. And the only reason I was able to do it was on account of him. But I heard another magic phrase that we will hear in AA. And I heard this, if you're willing to help yourself, we are willing to help you too. And that's my first day in AA. And you know, AA, I never make a talk that I don't mention 6 men that played a major part in my sobriety. After I'd been sober a few days, my sponsor made arrangements for me to be in a home, a boarding house where there were 6 other alcoholics. And none of us had a job. I don't know where my clothes came from or where the money came from to feed me my first 6 months in Alcoholics Anonymous, but it came from somewhere. And these 6 men gave me much, and I'll tell you why. I saw one of these 6 men. I helped burn on account of going back to the bottle. He decided he would stop going to meetings. Had 13 years sobriety, and he didn't need to go to meetings anymore. One man went crazy. For a period of time, up to last summer, this past summer, 2 of those men stopped drinking and have been sober, and 2 of them are back on the bottle and have been for 11 and a half years until this summer. 2 of them are sober today. And these 2 men that drank for 11 and a half years after I stopped came to see me and said, Dave, says, why you and not us? And the only answer that I could give them is simply what was read and what I've been trying to talk about tonight. Follow the directions. And that's all I've done tonight. Is just follow the direction. Follow the path of some other person that has led the way for me. And that's the reason I'm here tonight, as far as I'm concerned. AA was good to me in Roanoke. I got physically sober. Physically sober. And it wasn't long before AA sat me down one day and says, why don't you go to work and go into the field that you studied? Now, you know, this makes sense. Why don't I go into engineering? And after all, that was to be my career. And through AA, I went to see a man about a job through the Virginia Highway Department simply by telling the truth about me. And there is no defense against the truth. I found that out. Because when you tell them these things, they just stand there in complete amazement. And this man hired me. And I was on my way to make a few bucks. And I don't know whether this was good for me at that time or not. But along about that time, after about 5 months of sobriety, I met the woman that was to become my wife. Some of you know Sue. And I wish she were here tonight. She couldn't come. But Sue has gone through more hell and is still going through more hell than my first wife did, because Sue has never seen me take a drink, never seen me drunk. But she's seen me try to grow up in this program, try to grow up, and I'm still trying to grow up. And she's been wonderful to me. And this woman began to help me. She's an anesthesiologist. She knows something about medicine. And she understood me, and she tried to help me. But I had another problem when I got sober. This first wife I had, she decided she wanted me back. She really did. Now, mine's a little bit different. Mine's a little bit different. And somewhere in the book it says that you have to change your playmates, you know. And I remember after I'd been sober for about 8 months, this woman came up to Roanoke and began to make all kinds of trouble for me. And we had agreed to a divorce previously. And I hired me a good AA lawyer. Tom, no reflection on you, but I hired me one that hadn't been sober as long as I had. And we just had a mess, and I was making a little money, and I spent all this money trying to get the divorce, and I lost this divorce. And I'll never forget the day we came out of the courthouse, and my sponsor began to talk to me, and he was laughing. And he says, "I'm so glad you didn't get the divorce." And if I had a gun, I'd have shot him. But I didn't understand what he meant at that time, but I do today. And that afternoon, I asked him finally, I said, "Why did you say that?" And he says, "Dave," he says, "until you learn how to love that woman's soul, you will never be released. When you do, you shall be released." And he promised this to me. And I wasn't capable of loving anybody's soul at that time. I really wasn't. And I began to fight this thing. And finally, I began to be real active in the group, you know. Had a job, began to have some faith. And at that time, I thought faith was something you carried around in your hip pocket. And people began to notice me as I walked into the group meetings. Been sober for about 6 months. And finally, they let me talk one night. I'll never forget that as long as I live. Seriously, it doesn't embarrass me a bit if people ask me to stop talking when I'm standing up here, because I was trained that way. I've been asked to sit down many a time when I was talking. And that night, I gave a talk on how not to slip. Never heard of it, but I gave one. And I'd been gone about 20 minutes, and my sponsor grabbed me by the arm, came up to the podium, said, "Sit down. You said enough." And really. And the thought was, as I took my glory walk, you know, back to humility row, I said to myself, "Well, I've got a little bit too much power for him tonight. I'm talking about this." And you know, this is where the old-timer came in. And these old-timers, I thank God for them, because these are the people I listen to. The person that has been here longer than I have, they have something for me. And one of the old-timers, God bless them, they tell you things that when they speak to you like this, you take it as a compliment. But when you go home and really begin to think, it ain't that, you know. I got up after the meeting, and old Jim came up to me, and he says, "Dave," says, "I want to tell you something." He says, "You know something?" Says, "At the rate you're going, you're going to be the next governor of the state of Virginia." That night, I believed him. I really did. I thought I was. Well, I began to be a soul saver. I had a little book that I kept the people that had some success in the program, I got credit for it. If they failed, my sponsor got into the act somewhere, and he fouled it all up. And I went through a phase in sponsorship. I don't know about you. You see, when I first got sober in AA, I really thought my sponsor was God. I really did. And along about this period of time, I thought he was something else, and you know what I'm talking about. I thought he was something else. When he began to tell me things I needed to do, that I had to do if I wanted to stay sober. Today I love him as a brother. I really do. Because this man began to tell me something about the 14 promises of AA. And I've seen some of them fulfilled in my life. And I know a lot of them are possible. I know it with all my heart, because I've seen it happen to you. Because you too have followed these directions. Well, I began to be the backbone of the whole group, you know, after about a year. And saving souls. I began to be around a bunch of people in AA, and I don't know if it's true, but in your part of the country, but I'm telling you my experiences, my story. I'm no authority on Alcoholics Anonymous, The only thing that I'm authority on is what happened to this drunk and how I find my sobriety. But I begin to be around a bunch of people in AA that I call a group within a group. And they begin to talk to me some trash. And they begin to tell me, says, listen, boy, you don't have to do some of these things. You just take what you want and throw the rest away. And I damn near went out to wonder with it all, let me tell you. Because when I got through, and it doesn't take an intelligent person to tear these 12 steps apart if you're sick enough. When I got through, I had one step, maybe part of the 12th I thought. That's all I had. That's all I had after a year and a half sobriety. And there was a reason for it. Because I got important. I got important. I began to find myself going 300 miles to make a talk, but I wouldn't go 1 mile to listen. And when you get like this, you're getting sick. And I got sick. As old Wesley says, I begin to have that football in my stomach. And people around me begin to bug me, in particular my sponsor. But one day the old timers called me in my sponsor and sat me down in a conference room at the clubhouse and began to tell me some things about me that I didn't know. And Jack told me, he says, Dave, he says, I want to tell you something. He says, at the rate you're going, you're going to get drunk. And this is a heck of a thing to be telling the backbone of the group he's going to get drunk. But that's what he did. He says, you're going to get drunk. You have never gotten honest with yourself. Do you know what the program is? And we begin to talk about the program. And no man had ever had a better foundation on the 12 steps of the program of AA when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous than I did through my sponsor. But I began to listen to people that were in this group within a group. And he says, the only chance you've got is to get honest with yourself and start working this program, which are the 12 steps. And he says, when was the last time you thanked God for your sobriety? When was the last time you thanked him? And I couldn't remember. I couldn't. And I'd been sober a year and a half. And that night I went back to my room and shut myself up when they got through with me. And I resented this conversation. I never heard anybody doing this, but I was going to give them a written resignation from Alcoholics Anonymous. That's the truth. I was going to resign. And that night I got in this room, and as we say, enough had rubbed off on me that I began to think a little, and I began to think about what they said to me, and finally I did what they told me to do. I got on my knees and prayed to a God I knew nothing about, nothing. And I asked for help through a simple juvenile prayer. And you have to understand, at that time, God to me was... It was a question mark in the sky, really. That was my understanding of God, just a question mark in the sky. Maybe yes, maybe no. But the end result of this prayer was that I was able to go into a bathroom and look at myself for the first time in my life, for the first time, and really know what I was. That I was a speck on this universe, and that I was born into the world, and someday I'll soon die and soon be forgotten. And the only chance that I had was through the program of AA. I had tried everything else. Tried everything. And the next night I went back to my group, and I had to eat some crow. And I had to do what they told me to do. And I began to clean those ashtrays and sweep that floor. And I've never stopped. And I hope I never do. I belonged to AA then when I went back. And there is a difference in going to AA, as far as I'm concerned, and belonging. And I believe it. If I had to argue with one word in the big book, it would be this thing, suggest. We suggest. That's the only thing I want to argue with. But thank God these people didn't tell me this. They said, you had better. There are no do's or don'ts, but there are a lot of you betters. And I began to do these things that they told me to do. And life began to take new strides for me. And it was about this time that I had to go back to North Carolina, because I still wanted this divorce in order to marry my wife, my present wife, Sue, and that was the only way I had of doing it, was going back to North Carolina, but I had learned how to love this woman's soul. I really had. And God looks after us in mysterious ways. Let me tell you something that happened to me in AA. And maybe you call it a coincidence, I don't know. Out of these six men in this boarding house that helped sponsor me, one of these men married my first wife. Really? Really? She didn't know a good thing when she had it. That's what I used to say. But this is the way the program worked for me, and I couldn't understand this for a while. I really didn't. But God does work in mysterious ways. And she has found a life for her, and he has a life, and I have a life. I went back to North Carolina, my home state. My sponsor had made arrangements for a man to get hold of me when I got there, and some of you knew him. He's dead and gone. He had a lot of sobriety. Tom Burrell. Tom got hold of me, and he was my sponsor down in North Carolina. And Tom was the man that rammed the big book down my throat, because I was one of these alcoholics that always asked questions to let people know how smart I was. And I'd ask old Tom a question. He said, get that book and start reading. And then I'll talk to you, and he would. And he was a lot of help to me. And I got an AA in North Carolina, and I've been there ever since. And I enjoy my AA in North Carolina. I'm just a grateful member of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's all I am. Really. If I had to offer any advice to anyone that's new, or if you're having trouble with the program, or if you're quarreling with yourself, if you're fighting with yourself, get a hold of the word truth. Or more briefly, get honest with yourself, because that's what I had to do before I was able to walk. Because I heard a man once say that when Jesus Christ walked the face of the earth in the body of a man, he didn't say, I'm a truthful man. He said, I am the truth. And I believe it's from this source and this root that we inherited this wonderful program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I've seen enough in my time in AA not only to believe but to know that if a man or woman has the ability to be honest with himself, the power that runs this universe stands ready to help you and set you on the road to recovery. A lot of my friends call this power the man upstairs. I choose to call him God. God is our understanding. A God that I've come to know through you, through Alcoholics Anonymous. And I didn't know anything about God. I didn't know anything about love. I really didn't. These things are wonderful. I'm a Blackstone baby. I'd been sober 1 year when they forced me to go to Blackstone against my wishes and carried me there and humiliated me by carrying me to one of these conferences or retreats, as they call them. And I began to look at these people around Blackstone, and these people began to hug and kiss each other. And I thought this was the most sickening thing I've ever seen in my life. And they said they loved each other. And I asked my sponsor, I remember when we left Blackstone, my first trip to Blackstone, I asked him, I said, Jack, do they really mean it? They're just putting on. Is it all show? And he said, no, Dave. He said, they really mean it. And that time, I was able to receive love, but I could not give love. I wasn't capable of giving love. I thought all love had a price on it. But gradually, through this program of being around new people, I found out what real love was, the love of my fellow man. I'll tell you one thing. I haven't made the program of AA. I haven't made the program. Maybe when I die and I'm soon forgotten, maybe you can say, and if I'm still in AA, Dave made the program then, but not until then. I've got a long, long ways to go. A long way. And why are we here tonight? Why is it a coincidence, as we've been talking about tonight, that Cecil is sober, that he's here? Is it a coincidence that I'm sober? That so many people in this room sober? Is it a coincidence? I don't think so. Because I've come to believe that a coincidence is an act of God in the midst of time. The God that has been doing for you and me what we've been unable to do for ourselves. That's the truth. And I long since learned that as long as I maintain my spiritual condition in the program of AA, that I will be granted this daily reprieve that we speak of, 1 day of sobriety. And the reason is simple. Because I can then fulfill the purpose of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that is to be of maximum service to God and my fellow man. And that's the only reason I'm here. I've never got anybody sober. Never have. Never will. If I knew anything about getting people sober, I'd never come here, because I'd got myself sober. But I really believe that I was loved sober in AA. I believe you can love an alcoholic sober, because I believe that's what happened to this drunk. And when a new man or a new woman walks in the door at my group, and that's where my prime responsibility is in my group, I want to look at that man as a woman, as a person. I want to know what makes him tick. And I want to love him and understand him, because that's all I've got to offer, is love and understanding, and give him this wonderful way of life. Sometimes, you probably like me, you see a new person and you say, well, I want you to have what I feel, but I want it right back. And I feel the same way about my AA. I really do. I really do. But I guess, that if I had to be more grateful for anything than my sobriety, I don't know what it would be. But to simply the opportunity to help another suffering alcoholic, I know this, that I have a responsibility through my God-given sobriety, and that's to help the suffering alcoholic, because when I go see a man or a woman, and I take him by the hand and say, I love you, and I understand, all I've got to do is say to myself, there but for the grace of God go I. That could be me. That could be me. I want to tell you about one little coincidence, if you call it a coincidence. And I usually forget to talk about this. It's about my mama. For a long, long time, well, not a long time, but for a period of time, my mama would not have anything to do with me. My mother did not believe I was sober for 3 years. She thought it was a gimmick to it. And when she found out I was sober, she wouldn't have anything to do with me. And after about 5 years sobriety, we began to see each other a little. But it took 9.5 years for my mother and I ever to come on terms where we could sit down and talk to each other as a mother and a son. Because my mother did not understand my being in AA. She could not understand why I could do this maybe for somebody else, but not her. And the way it happened was simply this. I'd been sober that period of time, and I was talking to my hometown group down in Eastern Carolina, and some old women that knew me when I was a little boy came to see me and see how this drunk had changed his life and heard me talk. And I just said what I'm saying tonight. And these women went home to see my mama and told her about her son. That he was just simply trying to help another person like him. That's all he was doing. And through these women, she was beginning to understand Alcoholics Anonymous. And they knew not too much about it. And that night when I got home, the phone rang, and my mother called me up for, I don't know how long it had been. And she said, son, says, I want you to forgive me. I want you to forgive me for the way I've treated you for the time you've been in AA. And my mama is just about a member of AA now. She's not an alcoholic, but she arranges a lot of meetings for me and calls me up and says, you coming down here next week and bring a group to talk and all this stuff. And I had the privilege of being with her for a period of time, although she was real ill last winter over at Durham. She was in Duke. I spent a lot of time with my mother, and I found out more things about me in my drunken days than I ever had before. And this woman loves me now for what I am, and I thank God for this too. I really do. But most of all, I thank God for all of you. Because if it hadn't been for you, I would not have had this day. And I want to tell you something, and I want you to understand this. I love you, and I want to thank you for never letting me be alone again. And that means so much to me that I don't have to be alone anymore. And just remember one thing. Your Heavenly Father will never, never let you down. Thank you, and God bless you.